Spectacular Unredacted.
This week, we're taking you on a whistle-stop tour of how the Macular Society, one of Britain's biggest sight loss charities, managed to drive straight into a governance crisis, with the handbrake off and the headlights out. I'm Owen Halibut, a blind businessman with a passion for the sight loss sector, and I've partnered with Friends of Macular Media to bring you this investigative podcast into the unfolding scandal at the Macular Society. Before we get started, a bit of housekeeping. I know, unusual for episode one, but the trailer seems to have stirred up a lot more interest than we expected. So five quick things. First off, the podcast should now be live on Spotify, and it'll be rolling out to the other big platforms over the next few days. It turns out getting listed everywhere is a more painful process than you'd think. So thanks for your patience while we wrangle the tech. Quite a few of you have asked whether the society or its leadership might come after us for defamation. Fair question. But here's the thing. We're sitting on over 2,000 pages of evidence, more than 400 leaked emails, 27 hours of video, 13 and a half hours of audio, 11 first-hand testimonies. We don't say anything we haven't fact-checked. So, sleep easy. On a related note, yes, we've got heavyweight professional advice behind us, top employment lawyers, HR directors from the charity and education sectors, a FTSE 250 data protection expert. We won't be pulling punches, but we will be treading carefully. Now, about our email inbox, you lot have practically melted it in the last 24 hours. Our spam filter had a bit of a nervous breakdown and decided to heave some perfectly good messages into the void. We're clearing the backlog, but if you don't hear back by next week, you might need to resend. And finally, that all-staff meeting on Wednesday the 10th. We've heard all about the speeches. We've heard about Ed Holloway suddenly backtracking on his "no such thing as a bad question" line. We'll have more to say about that in a future episode. With all of that said, shall we dive in? Let's start with a machine gun run-through of what has happened to date. Fundraising and services leadership allegedly let a £650,000 black hole open in the budget. No plans, no strategy, no impact data to stop it. Management launches a cost-cutting restructure. A senior fundraiser blows the whistle, is promptly suspended, then resigns in protest, and is understood to be pursuing a claim for constructive dismissal and whistleblower retaliation. 25 staff put in consultation. Management refused to share the data or business case they're legally required to disclose, so staff can't produce meaningful alternatives. The team start organising. Management brand it harassment rather than legitimate challenge. Then, suddenly, leadership get hold of the team's private WhatsApp chat log. How? They won't say. The team call foul play. Data laws are seemingly ignored. Management admits making improper data requests and misunderstanding the relevant guidance. 18 people investigated, evidence helpful to staff. Redacted. Only the damaging bits survive. 9 face gross misconduct hearings. The team take it to the High Court. The judge earnestly recommends a complaint to the Charity Commission. 3 get final warnings. 5 are fired. 1 remains in limbo on maternity leave. The main charge? Bullying the CEO, Ed Holloway. Which is curious. Given the charity quietly reached a settlement with someone who had accused Emma Malcolm, Director of Income and Transformation, of bullying him. And Ed Holloway, the CEO, of covering it up. Though, of course, the society made no admission of liability. Part 1. Trouble at the top. It all starts in early 2023. Emma Malcolm, then Director of Fundraising and Marketing, suddenly finds herself in charge of services as well. Sounds fine on paper. Except there was no services strategy, no fundraising strategy to support services, no plan at all, apparently. We've seen the emails, the CEO at the time, Kathy Yelf, senior fundraisers, the board, all sounding the alarm. A £650,000 gap was opening up between what the services needed and what they could actually secure from a funders like the National Lottery, thanks to the lack of impact data and any real strategy. Emma, it seemed, was either unwilling or simply unable to put a concrete plan on paper, something she could be held accountable for. Though, given the article she wrote for The Sun, cheerfully confessing that her runaway debts were only saved by a lucky redundancy payout, perhaps we shouldn't be too shocked. After all, lightning does occasionally strike twice. Part 2. Enter Ed Holloway. Fast forward to mid-2024. Ed Holloway arrives as the new CEO. On paper, Ed looks solid. Over 13 years at the MS Society. Well-liked, effective. But then it all starts to unravel. He spent 2 years as CEO of the Bank Workers Charity and left under what records show to be a secretive £63,000 settlement. We have spoke with staff who worked with him at the time, and they described his leadership as, let's say, less than inspirational. When Ed joined the Macula Society, he told staff he loved challenge, loved debate, wanted to be surrounded by people who knew more than him. The reality, not so much. Part 3. The apology meeting. Things came to a head in early 2025 when two senior fundraisers asked Ed to deliver on a meeting he himself had promised. His reaction? He hauled them into his office with Emma Malcolm sitting silently as witness and made them apologise for asking him to keep his word. When they finally said sorry to keep the peace, he demanded to know exactly what they were apologising for and why. Both left the room feeling humiliated. One quit soon after. Emma Malcolm, we're told, did a little cheer in front of the individual when she heard the news. Part 4. Redundancies on repeat. Then came 31st March 2025. Regional services staff got an email. They were being placed into a consultation with many at risk of redundancy. No warning, no conversations, just boom. 53 minutes later, the rest of the charity was told too, so some found out they were at risk because colleagues started messaging them asking if they were okay. Imagine handling something like this at arm's length, by email with no real engagement, when many staff have over a decade of service. It's hard to envisage worse people management or a bigger failure to safeguard the organization's culture. The team asked for the data behind the cuts. Budgets, strategies, anonymized salaries, alternative options. Management said the budgets were too complicated for them. The strategies didn't exist. The salaries couldn't be shared. The alternatives wouldn't be shown. All they got was a single-page proposal, the kind which seems designed to make any counter-proposal impossible. Part 5. Legal lines crossed. Now this is where things get technical, but vital. UK law requires collective consultation only when an employer proposes to dismiss 20 or more staff at one site in a 90-day period. In this case, the society was formally looking to make 10 to 12 redundancies, so legally that threshold wasn't crossed. But HR experts warn, when you're dealing with such a large proportion of your workforce, best practice clearly leans toward holding something very much like collective consultation. Even if the law doesn't force you to, what the society did instead was split the redundancy process into three artificially segregated consultations. One with one person, another with five, and a third with 19. Meanwhile, publicly, it was presented as one unified transformation plan. They also ring-fenced roles and structured selection pools in ways that the employment lawyer advising Macula Unredacted argues risked the predetermination of who would be made redundant. That's not how redundancy is supposed to work. It's meant to be fair, open, based on clear criteria, not about engineering outcomes under the guise of process. Patterns like these attract tribunal scrutiny, as the design appears to have steered outcomes. If the allegations are proved, there could be serious claims of unfair dismissal and reputation, legal and financial exposure for management. Part 6. Whistleblowers and WhatsApp. By April, a senior fundraiser blew the whistle. Lack of strategy, bullying culture, legal risks. The board chair first thanked them for their bravery, then recategorized it as a grievance and sent it back to the same managers accused of misconduct. 2 weeks later, that whistleblower was suspended. We've even seen an email in which the CEO directly linked the suspension to their disclosure in writing. Against this backdrop, staff at risk of redundancy move their conversations off work systems onto WhatsApp, a private chat, over 20 members, mainly mutual support and information sharing, until management somehow got hold of it. How? Turns out Emma Malcolm proactively and emotionally appealed to one staff member, making it seem as if she had already seen the contents of the chat, who then briefly showed Ed Holloway her phone in hopes that the situation could be amicably de-escalated, Another was then phoned at home while alone and under medical supervision with an at-risk pregnancy and, under pressure, exported the entire chat. She later described feeling isolated, coerced. Her medical team even blamed the stress for complications in her pregnancy. Both individuals from whom the information was secured have since submitted grievances over their treatment and management's conduct. None have been heard yet, but already the senior leadership team, the trustees, and even their legal advisors are insisting there's no substance to either complaint before a single word of evidence has been presented. Part 7. Diving into WhatsApp. Now, I know what you're wondering. What exactly was said in that WhatsApp chat? Why all the drama? Let's get into it. No punches pulled, because there's no truth without light. The highlights, or lowlights, depending on your perspective. Someone compared the CEO's face to a lady's undercarriage. That's not me softening the language. That's verbatim. Someone else compared him to a guinea pig. The director of income and transformation got a rebrand as the director of fucking it up. And the director of not getting shit done. There were tongue-in-cheek comments about drowning the CEO in a vat of wine, losing him on a train, or hitting him with a rock. All clearly the sort of frustrated joke you share in the pub, not an actual threat. One blind team member called another blind colleague the Lord of the Blind, a jab at management's habit of treating one person's opinion as the only voice of blind people. Management tried to spin this as disability discrimination, which appears to demonstrate their lack of understanding around these issues, more than it does anything else. There were plenty of blunt assessments of management competence, or lack thereof, and lots of talk about whistleblowing, union membership, and other ways to resist what the team saw as a sham redundancy process, with that legitimate resistance being labelled as bullying and undermining. In total, management pulled around 30 messages out of more than 1,400 and announced they were focused on content, not context. Very convenient, because the other 1,370 messages were about things like staff mental health collapsing under the pressure, fears that volunteer group funds were being centralised without input, and plans to whistleblow about it. Legal advice suggesting the charity wasn't meeting its obligations. Staff expressing that there was no point. They'd been stripped of their work, told not to plan for the future, and cut off from their colleagues. Colleagues supporting each other not to quit in despair because resigning meant losing redundancy payouts. And well wishes for those who did quit because they simply couldn't take it anymore. Now look, no one likes reading nasty comments about themselves. Even senior leaders have feelings. But as the independent investigator, B360, put it, it is understandable in the circumstances that staff have many questions about the restructure. They are at risk of losing their jobs. Much of the WhatsApp chat is about the detail of that. It is not surprising that the general tone of the group is negative. It is not surprising that so many emails have been sent with many questions. And here's the kicker. HR redacted that line before staff saw the investigation report. The same report they were supposed to use to prepare their defence. We'll get into that later. But let's just say, it doesn't exactly scream, nothing to see here. Part 8. The whistleblower who wasn't. After staff discovered management had got hold of their private WhatsApp chat, they demanded answers. On what legal basis had management processed their personal data? Data that included health information, union membership, plans for whistleblowing disclosures, even photos of children and families. All taken together under UK law, the chat log counts as special category data. Processing it requires a serious justification and a formal balancing exercise to prove the public interest outweighs the very high bar for data privacy rights. Conveniently, management produced an ACE card. They claimed the data had come from a whistleblower protected under the Public Interest Disclosure Act, which just happens to be one of the few legal routes by which that data could be obtained and processed. The problem? The supposed whistleblower has now filed a grievance saying she is no such thing, and management had no right to label her as one. How does breaching staff's inalienable data rights in order to uncover some unkind comments about the CEO who is making them redundant serve the public interest? It doesn't. It falls far short of the relevant legal test. And why do whistleblower protections suddenly matter so much when they work in management's favour, but disappear the moment staff try to invoke them? Part 9. Data Rights Wild West. Through all of this, management kept the regional services team at arm's length, engaging with and sharing as little information as possible. One volunteer group leader summed it up perfectly. Ed's strategy seems to be to treat everyone like mushrooms, keep them in the dark, and feed them shit. So the team started digging for answers themselves. 16 May, staff filed data subject access requests to find out what data the society held on them. Legally, organizations get 1 month to comply, but James Price, head of data and insight, declared it was exceptionally complex and invoked the full 3 months the ICO allows in rare cases. 3 months later, after disciplinary hearings had already happened, the data finally arrived. Badly organized, incomplete. No explanation of why it took so long. Then came the twist. After the Phase 1 investigation report landed, finding not much to back management's narrative, James Price fired off his own data subject access requests, this time to staff, demanding they hand over all data about Ed Holloway on their personal devices and social media accounts, or face disciplinary action. Staff pointed out this was blatantly improper. James quickly rode back, admitting he had misunderstood data protection guidance. But don't worry, he'll definitely have gotten it right on the far more complex issue of processing special category data in what looked suspiciously like a retaliatory context. Right? Meanwhile, because the investigation report given to staff had been so heavily redacted, with entire evidence appendices stripped out, the team sent a separate data subject access request to B360, the investigation company itself. They stalled until the very last legal day, released almost nothing, and removed all the same material the society had redacted. If that's not collusion to deny staff rights, what is? And here's the punchline. They hadn't even redacted the report properly. A blind colleague's screen reading software sailed straight through the black boxes and revealed everything. A rare win for accessibility and a moment of poetic justice. Part 10. To redact or not to redact. Facing gross misconduct charges with the threat of summary dismissal is serious stuff. UK law, it's an ACAS guidance, say employers must tread carefully, fairly. And the cornerstone of fairness. Employees must be given all the evidence against them so they can defend themselves properly. But that's not the route management took. Instead, they appointed an independent investigator to give the appearance of fairness, but never allowed any of the accused staff to meet them. The investigator got the WhatsApp log and 90-minute interviews with Emma Malcolm and Ed Holloway about how bullied they felt. Controlling what evidence can and can't be seen completely negates the point of an independent investigation. Withheld whole pieces of evidence, the appendices table, completely redacted, and some choice passages from the report, also blacked out. Passages like, clear evidence about undermining Ed Holloway is limited and it is unlikely to meet the threshold of insubordination in the disciplinary policy. Or, the volume and nature of emails is clearly a frustration and a burden to Emma Malcolm and Ed Holloway, but it is unlikely this reaches the threshold of bullying or harassment. Or, it is understandable staff have many questions about the restructure. It is not surprising the general tone of the group is negative. It is not surprising so many emails have been sent with many questions, all removed. Now, people manager Zaga Makecha insists every redaction was for confidentiality reasons, but it's hard to see how blacking out passages helpful to the defence, but leaving in the ones useful to management, serves confidentiality rather than narrative control. That said, there is one particularly spicy comment about the CEO I can see why they wanted gone. We'll save that for the episode where we dissect these reports in full. Part 11. Off to the High Court. Amid all this chaos, the team became convinced that management had unlawfully accessed their personal data, a retaliatory fishing expedition to shut down growing resistance to the redundancy process. So they gathered a 400-page evidence bundle and took themselves to London's High Court to meet the Honourable Mr. Justice Mellor on the morning of 31st July 2025. It was tense, nerve-wracking. The team felt out of their depth. But with each other's backing, a passionate belief in their cause, and some heavyweight legal support, they made their case. They sought an interim injunction, one that would have stopped management from processing or using their personal special category data. The judge listened carefully. He was fair, thoughtful, and ultimately unable to grant it. Not because the case lacked merit, but because the team had applied without notice, meaning the Macular Society hadn't been invited to appear. The team argued this was because the process so far felt rigged, and they feared management would manipulate it if given the chance. But the judge said open justice had to take priority. Without the society present, he couldn't grant the injunction. The judge explained that having applied without notice, the team were unable to reapply with notice, as there wasn't enough time. What he did do was strongly recommend the evidence be sent to the Charity Commission, given the seriousness of the allegations and the seniority of those involved. We understand that referral is now underway. We'll keep you updated as it unfolds. Part 12. Grievances and grievances and grievances. Oh my. All through this saga, the team kept filing grievances whenever their legal advisors said the Macular Society was trampling on their employment rights. These weren't half-baked complaints. They were detailed, evidence-heavy, legally grounded. Not one was upheld. Raise evidence that the process was biased. Zaga's reply, "We are satisfied the process is fair. This is the end of the matter." Point out that there was no whistleblower, that the data was coerced from staff. Jessica Kirby's response, "We are satisfied there was a whistleblower." Though Jessica made this determination without ever speaking to either of the individuals who accused the society of coercion. At the final appeal hearing, trustees Amanda Rowland and Alison Guthrie listened as the individual who handed over the chat log explained, directly, that Anthony Thorne had pressured her into handing over the data, despite her saying no repeatedly. The trustees decided she'd done it voluntarily. So did the society's lawyers at Paris Smith LLP. This, while both grievances from the staff involved remain outstanding, explicitly claiming the opposite. One of the individuals to have alleged they were coerced has repeatedly told management that her medical team directly linked the stalled growth of her unborn baby to the extreme stress of being coerced into handing over her personal data. So far, no one seems willing to hear it. Part 13. And like that, here we are. 5 months, that's how long the team have spent raising every alarm they could, trying to fix this quietly without harming the organisation they care about. And for 5 months, the message from management, HR and the board has been the same. Nothing to see here. Now the process has run its course. 3 people handed final written warnings, 5 dismissed outright, and 1 still in maternity limbo. No date set for her disciplinary hearing. If I told you the entire process, every meeting, every decision, every dismissal had been handled without care, without basic procedural fairness, sometimes even with contempt. Would you be surprised? I wouldn't. Part 14. What's next? And that's where we leave things. For now. Next time, we'll rewind the clock. We'll dig through the 24 months before Ed Holloway ever set foot in the Macular Society, trawl the email archives and ask the obvious question. How on earth did we end up here? We're not here to attack a good cause. We're here to ask, why do so many loyal employees feel betrayed? Why are decisions driven by ego, not evidence? And what must change to protect staff, beneficiaries, and the charity's future? If leadership steps up, treats staff fairly, and resolves claims, this story ends here. Until then, we keep investigating, because sunlight is the best disinfectant. Episodes drop fast. Friday, 12th September, Episode 2. The Seeds of the Crisis. The 24 months of warnings ignored before Ed Holloway took over. Monday, 15th September, Episode 3. The Holloway Era Begins. How the new CEO and senior leadership drove staff morale off a cliff. After that, weekly episodes will dig deeper. Redacted reports, high court hearings, whistleblowing retaliation, and what the Charity Commission now knows. Follow the story at macularunredacted.org or on any major podcast platform. We're urging all Macular Society staff who feel unsettled about the future to join Unite the Union so there's a permanent collective voice for employees, a voice that outlasts leadership changes and protects the culture built by the people actually delivering the work. And if you have information to share, email disclosure at macularunredacted.org. Confidentiality guaranteed. Until next time, try not to trample on anyone's employment rights.